And hello, welcome to Life Matters on RN. Natasha Mitchell in the chair, fair and square. Good to have your company this morning. If you're a Muslim child and you need to be placed in a foster family, would it be appropriate for you to end up in, say, a Catholic family, a foster family that's Catholic? What if you were an Aboriginal child and you were placed with white foster parents? The question of whether cultural background matters in child protection interventions, well, you'd think it would matter, but why does it? Also coming up on the show in about 20 minutes or so, the grand finale of the meditation challenge we've been running. Did you give it a go, even in a small way? We'll be opening up the phone lines today to have your experiences aired. Feel free to start that conversation now over on our Facebook page. That and more coming your way on the show today. If you're thinking of becoming a foster parent, you'll have all sorts of questions about what it involves, about the child, their history, their age, any special needs they might have. But in placing a particular child with particular foster parents, how much notice is taken of the child's cultural heritage? Sometimes surprisingly little, as you're about to hear. And different groups also have different interpretations of child-rearing practices and also sometimes what's considered maltreatment, how to navigate that complex picture. Jatinder Kaur has been doing research and reviewing research on these issues, and she joins us this morning on the show. Welcome, Jatinder.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you here. And to draw on the Indigenous experience of foster care, where we have a lot of learnings to share here, is Bill Pritchard. He's the Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Child, Family and Community Care State Secretariat, or ABSEC for short. I'm no doubt you use that more often. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Tasha. Definitely ABSEC.
Yes, indeed. Jatinder, to your research, we're a hugely culturally diverse country. Now, it surprises me to hear that that you've found that data on a child's cultural and linguistic background is very patchy in terms of its collection. Tell us about the gaps in the data.
Well, I mean, across Australia, there's about 37,500 children in out-of-home care. And of that, we know there's about 12,500 children that identify as from Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background. So the remaining 25,000 children, we actually don't know how many are from a migrant or a refugee background. And I think part of the issues or data gaps is around the fact that governments have probably not really considered that other cultural background children and young people are coming into the system. And also the IT systems are probably not as sophisticated, which actually allow them to collect country of origin or language spoken or religious status.
Does it surprise you that that sort of information isn't formally collected?
I think it's a real issue that data isn't being collected, because when you don't know how what the prevalence rates are for different community groups, that leads to a lack of policy and programs or services for particular vulnerable groups. So when you don't have the data, you actually don't know how big the problem is.
What are the consequences for children, for example?
So if the child protection system doesn't know what the cultural background is of, say, a migrant family or a refugee family or a Muslim family, what will happen is they'll come into the system, and the system will most likely not really consider all of those factors regarding culture, ethnicity, religious practices, language spoken. So some of the outcomes that I've seen through my experience has been that, you know, children who have been able to speak a language at home, whether it was Burundi or whether it was Dinka, they could speak the language, they can speak to their parents, but when they come into care and they've been placed with Australian foster parents, they've lost their language.
So when they go back to their birth family, what are the consequences? They can't speak with their parents anymore.
That's right. They can't speak. And, you know, the parents really struggle because they haven't learnt English or they're not proficient in English. And then the children and young people can no longer communicate with their parents. So you have a real loss of culture, language and identity because the governments haven't really considered those factors as part of their placement principle.
Well, more than that, you end up with what might be a very difficult set of relationships in that family as they try and, you know, navigate their cultural differences now because they don't share a common language.
That's correct.
Mm. Bill Pritchard, I gather it's a legislative requirement to record whether a foster child is from Indigenous or Torres Strait Islander background. Why is that considered important and why is it enshrined in legislation?
It's enshrined in legislation throughout Australia and it's been reinforced with the bringing of the National Child Protection Framework, which is the federal government's response to child protection. I think it's a realisation that the number of Aboriginal children who have been coming into care over the years and the stolen generations, it's resulted in a need to address the numbers. Whether the legislation is a catch-all and works is a moot point, but I believe that there are efforts being made and there's recognition that we have to do better, and that legislation at least gives us a starting point.
Mm. How is that information, once that data is collected, because there are some interesting precedents here for the wider culturally diverse community of kids who end up in foster care. So how is that data used in terms of informing where that child is then placed in foster care?
Well, it varies between states, but I'm speaking from New South Wales' perspective at the moment. If a child is identified, then efforts are to be made adhere to the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle.
Which says?
That the child should be in their community with their family if possible, if not with another community member, if not with another Aboriginal person, and then only then should they be placed with a non-Aboriginal carer.
Now, the reality is very different, isn't it? The stats here are quite interesting in terms of where Indigenous children end up in foster care, often with Anglo parents.
Yeah, I think there's a few factors that impact recruiting carers, and again, the history of the stolen generations makes it difficult to recruit Aboriginal carers. There's a lot of kinship placements in New South Wales and in other states, which we're happy about, but it's those that where we can't find kinship placements that struggle, and they're the ones that end up in non-Aboriginal family. And
it's upwards of 50% though of children that end up in non-Aboriginal families. Yes.
Yes, unfortunately, and that's been acknowledged, and We're hopeful that some of the reforms that are coming through will actually address that. As Jacinta said, we need to keep culturally connected.
Why do we need to keep culturally connected? I mean, this sounds like a really obvious question, especially in the context of the stolen generations, but might it depend on circumstances? For example, if you have a foster family who are very committed to connecting that child back to their Indigenous community and heritage while the child is in their care, can that work just as well if it's difficult to find an Aboriginal family that will foster the child?
I don't think it works as well. I don't think you could say that. Those that do actually keep them connected, and I will admit there's some great non-Aboriginal carers of Aboriginal kids who and caseworkers who develop adequate cultural care plans, but it is about that connection. How do you go home? Often the non-Aboriginal carers aren't in the community and aren't accepted by the community. They're seen as taking the children, so it becomes really hard to connect. There is a commitment at the moment that all Aboriginal children in New South Wales will be placed with Aboriginal carers, in Aboriginal agencies with Aboriginal caseworkers, and we see that as the answer, and we hope that expands.
Aboriginal caseworkers, we'll come back to that because there's a shift there, isn't there, in terms of the shift into the NGO sector of child protection, out-of-home care facilitation. Jatinder Kaur, back to you. The ideal is to keep children with their families. There are complications here, though, that you've documented too, around cultural differences in terms of what families define as neglect or maltreatment. Just explain that for us with some examples.
Okay. So what happens in, and for some families or newly arrived families who might be coming from the Horn of African countries or from the Middle Eastern countries, there is no such thing as a child protection system in their country of origin. So when they come here to Australia, what they're finding is that when issues come up with, say, physical discipline, so in their country, as part of their traditional child rearing practices, it's okay to smack your child. It's okay to discipline your child because that's been accepted practice passed on, you know, as part of the community. But when they come to Australia, what's happening is that no one is actually educating those families that in Australia, it's not okay to smack your child.
Mind so, you, a lot of people do it, but we're talking about a different kind of extreme here, perhaps.
Yes. And, you know, there's no consistency. So what happens is that they get reported to child protection agencies and then child protection becomes involved. And then that leads to a whole process of, you know, investigation and assessment and then looking at whether the parent is being protective or not. But if you think about some of these families, they've protected their children through war and conflict, armed conflict. You know, they've fled, you know, militias. So they have that protective instinct, but yet when they come here, they might be labelled as being abusive.
Yes, not all abuse issues are going to have a cultural base, though, are they? And this, this is where child protection workers need to be mindful and sensitive of the situation.
Yep. The other, I guess, scenario that's bringing a lot of families to the attention is around neglect or inadequate supervision. So what's happening is because a lot of newly arrived families don't have their social support system, like, you know, extended parents or families, aunts and uncles, to help with the children, they are relying on their teenage, older children to look after the younger children.
And that is viewed as neglect.
That's correct. Whereas culturally accepted, and back in their country, a teenager, you know, young girl, would be culturally appropriate for her to look after her younger siblings, you know, be taught how to learn how to cook and care and tend to her younger siblings.
Well, that's all very well. So what though needs to happen here? Does it need to be a much more active conversation with those families about what is and isn't viewed as acceptable?
I think...
Is it as absolute as that?
You are going to have the extremes, but I think on the initial part of it, we need to put more concerted effort into early intervention and prevention. I mean, the amount of investment that government's put in, it's very minimal. Effort is put into actually educating and informing families about what is accepted, what are the Australian parenting norms, what's child abuse neglect, the impact of domestic and family violence on children and young people. There's not enough done.
Bill Richard, let me come back to you. You've seen some changes in New South Wales in terms of the foster care of Indigenous children that you find encouraging. What's the shift that you find positive?
Well, the shift is to the transition of out-of-home care from the government to the non-government sector. We see this as a real positive. The government's committed to it. For us, as Aboriginal people, we will be able to attract more carers because they won't see themselves as working for the welfare, working for DOCS, now called community services. We believe that Aboriginal people want to care and want to be foster carers, but they're just still the residual hangover from the stolen generations.
So you might see a sort of proliferation of Indigenous service providers in the NGO sector that will facilitate foster care for kids.
And this is already happening. We've got about 8 new agencies, partnerships and standalone agencies ready to start taking the transition of Aboriginal children, and we just see that as a real positive.
Why is it positive for an individual child's being put in placement, do you think?
Well, because they will be culturally connected and they'll stay culturally connected, and they're working for local, they're being looked after by local agencies, so they're agencies in their own communities, so that they just stay connected from the day they come into care and hopefully till the day they go home. And it's also about working with the birth families to actually say, well, how are we going to get this child home?
Yes, last week we spoke about a call in New South Wales to prioritise adoption over foster care, and the Minister for Family and Community Services, Prue Goward, popped in. And the aim is there's a push to provide children with a more permanent care over their childhood rather than have them move from foster home to foster home to foster home. But in the discussion paper they've released, they've said this is not an appropriate option for Indigenous children. I guess that's challenging, isn't it? Because do Indigenous children not deserve the same sort of sense of permanency in terms of their placements?
Oh, we totally believe in permanency. It's I suppose it's a moral thing. Adoption isn't a part of Aboriginal society. It is there are more than one carer of a child in Aboriginal society. We have extended familial family relationships, and it's often, you know, it might be the auntie looking after the child, and while they may grow up with their auntie or the grandmother, naturally, even if they weren't in foster care. So we just think that needs to be taken into account when any Aboriginal child comes into care. We suggest that we believe in permanency, but we think like guardianship and things like that are a better option rather than adoption.
Jacinda, very finally to you, do you, reading the situation for Indigenous children and foster care, are there things we can learn here for the wider culturally diverse community of kids?
I think definitely there's a lot of parallels, particularly around cross-cultural practice and understanding the importance of culture and recognising that culture is not a deficit. It's actually, it promotes resilience and promoting that identity. Because what happens when children and young people don't know who they are or where they're from or can't maintain their cultural connection, when they leave the care system, they're lost. They don't belong to their community group because they're shunned and they don't necessarily fit into mainstream Australian society. So
kind of a no man's land.
That's correct. And if we can, you know, learn from, I guess, some of the best practices in you know, ensuring cultural connectedness from, you know, working with Aboriginal families and translate some of that into working with migrant and refugee families, I think we would have a better system.
Yeah, that'd be a very powerful coalition, I think, of awareness. Can I thank you both for joining us on the program this morning? Bill Pritchard, Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Child, Family and Community Care State Secretariat, or ABSEC. Good on you. I know you've got a bad case of hay fever, so you've survived.
Thank you, Natasha.
And Jacinda Kaur, thank you very much for joining us too.
Thank you.
A researcher with JK Diversity Consultants, I think your own consultancy company.
That's correct.
Thanks very much. And a very interesting paper that you've written on this issue too. Well, interested in your thoughts on this. Are you a foster parent? Are you a child who went through the foster care system and found it hard to stay culturally connected to your heritage? Please do get in contact on our website. You can post comments there. You can email us as well. Or there's our listener feedback line, 02833 1430, 02833 1430. Love to hear from you on this one. You're on RN. Coming up, the finale of our meditation challenge.
Tune in to RN Drive.
During the early session, there is a weeding out of the inefficient. You can say that it's like a Darwinian process that selects for success. But in a depression, all boats sink simultaneously.
You're painting a kind of scorched earth scenario. Is that really true?
Well, let's say that there's a high probability.
I think on net, the Australian economy will do okay, although I think unemployment will probably end up being closer to 6% by June next year.
Join me, Waleed Ali, Monday to Thursday on RN Drive.
Well, drum roll, it's the grand finale. We've reached the end of our six-week meditation challenge, which has been your challenge in some cases. Many of you said you wanted to give it a go. Some of you have stuck at it. Others maybe had a go once. Still others might have decided, no, mindfulness meditation is just not for you. Whatever your experience, today we're opening the phone lines to hear your thoughts, your experience of the challenge. Give us a call right now, 1300 22 55 76 1300 call RN. If you're in WA, Northern Territory, South Australia, and, well, I don't think Queensland, I think we're all in the same, call us 02833 1430. That's the listener feedback line. Unless you're listening live on the ABC Radio app or streaming online, then call 1300 2255 76. So we've looked at all sorts of things over the last few weeks, meditating with children, how to find a teacher that suits you if you're struggling to do it all on your own at home, and we've had a look at some of the scientific evidence of the benefits or otherwise of meditation. And right at the very beginning, we had the pleasure of having Matthew Johnston with us, illustrator and author. His latest book is Quiet the Mind, an illustrated guide on how to meditate. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Excellent to have you here, Matthew.
Good to be back.
And also joining me in our Brisbane studios, Claudine Ryan from the ABC's Health and Wellbeing website. Welcome back.
G'day, Natasha. How are you?
And, of course, you were trying all this with your children.
I know.
That was game. And Chantelle Jackson, a Life Matters listener who took up the challenge. Welcome back to the show, Chantelle.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Lovely to be here.
Excellent to have you. Chantelle.
Yep.
How's it been going? Give us a summary.
Going really well. It's been really helpful. I think one of the main things I got out of the challenge was, so I've been meditating, quote unquote, for about 10 years now and never really reached much quietness of mind. And I've always kind of wondered why that was. And after hearing one of your speakers talking about we're not our thinking mind at our best, we're our awareness, it suddenly clicked into me, I find it very difficult to let go of my thinking because I'm frightened. For me, thinking is what makes me feel like I'm holding things together or being in some kind of control of my life or myself or situations. Mm. And so that was really, really, I mean, it's quite confronting.
I can imagine.
Also, yeah, it was also really helpful. And so I've been working with that a little bit, and I think what I've found most helpful is I'm still doing the seated meditation, that first guided meditation by Craig Hassett. I really love that one, and partly because he does ground you in your body first.
And this is the audio guide that's up on our website.
Yep, that's that audio guide. So I really love that one, but also too, I do kind of dance that has meditative qualities to it.
Ooh.
So it's like walking meditation in some ways, but it's more dance-based and movement-based. And for me, that's also been very helpful because it's some ways about mindfulness, like you just notice what you're doing, but it's also about presence and being very present in your body. And for me, that gives me a place to let go. So if I'm letting go of my thinking, it gives me a place to let go into.
Wow.
So that I can go into my body, which is very strong and very present, and so that can hold and support me. Whereas if I'm just doing the breath, if I start letting go of my thought, it's just like floating. There's nowhere to go.
Yeah, and that's a very discombobulating feeling for people who, you know, I sometimes think I'm a head on legs. You know, we define ourselves by our heads. Matthew Johnston, have you heard of people using something like dance as a meditative opportunity?
Well, I use photography. Like a form of meditation and myself. And in fact, I'm working on a book at the moment around using photography as meditation. And I think it's a great to have a sort of a, when you're in the presence of doing something that actually captures your mind, or you can capture a moment, or whether it's through dance or through photography or through drawing, it's a wonderful way to become mindful.
I guess people wouldn't assume that you can do that, be really physically active and still stay really focused, but perhaps that's a, well, there you go. We're pushing at that intuition.
Well, quite often I meet people who say, you know, I've tried meditation. I really do believe there are some people out there who have incredibly busy minds, or who might be slightly anxious, or who might be slightly manic, who can't sit with themselves. You know, they find it incredibly difficult. Mm. So they do find that calmness through swimming, through dance, through running on the beach or whatever it is. So, that, you know, it's different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, definitely. Literally, if you're swimming.
Yes.
But I guess it's that kind of, you know, there's the rhythm of the breath that can be a focal point, but if you're swimming, there's the rhythm of your entire body.
That's right.
Which can also become a focus point. And Claudine Ryan, last time we spoke to you, you were attempting to do this with your husband and your two oldest children, two of three kids.
Yes.
How's the dynamic been going as you sit down every night to try and share this space together? I mean, you're kind of going within, but you're also doing it collectively, which I think is very challenging.
Well, it's look, where we're at now is we still occasionally do all four of us, but it's really sort of dropped off to me and my oldest son, who's about to start high school. So that is lovely and it works quite well.
How's it working for you, independent of you sitting in the presence of your child? How's it working internally for you? Where has it taken you,
this effort? Where has it taken me? Mm. Look, basically, I've really become a lot more aware of the chatter. You know, when we first scoped this project and first started talking to people about, you know, meditation, there was a lot of talk that actually made me feel a bit uncomfortable about, you know, being in the present and your mind, you know, and that internal chatter. It just, something about it took me back to, you know, yoga classes I'd done in my early 20s, and I just felt uncomfortable. But it's actually true. What it has done is made me aware of how much time, like you, I'm a head on legs.
It's a terrible image, I know, but it's, just,
I know, but it's
the
so
journalist's
true.
Way sometimes.
It is. And look, in many ways, it's been a real personal challenge to kind of accept that that's how I am and also see that there might be better ways of being sometimes. And look, the feedback I've had from those around me, the kids have actually observed independently of us, you know, not when we're talking about meditation or even thinking about it, but they'll say, "Mum, you're not as cranky at the moment."
that's a bit confronting, isn't it?
Oh, look, you know, and things like that. So, and I do feel calmer. You know, generally.
Okay, that's connecting with you, Matthew, obviously.
Absolutely. And I also think this whole thing about, you know, the chatter that we have. I actually meditated this morning. I got up at 5 and meditated. And quite often, you know, when I meditate, I can spend half my meditation just getting quiet.
Telling myself to shut up.
You know, but with love. it's a little bit like swimming in the ocean with floaties and trying to get down under the still water. You know, you really struggle to get under. And sometimes I don't get there. You know, sometimes my mind is so busy that I can't get there. But, you know, it's perseverance. And quite often I do get to that little point of quietness.
Yeah, I recently went back to a yoga class, hadn't done it for quite a long time. And the first part of it was meditation. And normally I adore that, but it's often at the end of the class rather than the beginning. And I found myself intensely frustrated that I couldn't quieten my mind, which I normally can in a yoga class because you've got that really physical focus. Anyway, it was quite confronting. We want to take your calls, 1300 225 76. 1300, call RN, 1300 225 76. Let me come to Vonda in Victoria. Now, you took up meditation 2 years ago. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Yeah. Well, actually, nearly 3 years ago, I first decided to do it because I had been trying for years before that, but never really got to it. And having trouble sleeping 2 hours in the middle of the night, I'd be awake and I thought, gee, I may as well use this usefully or constructively, or if I couldn't get off to sleep, I'd meditate. And so that's how I began doing it. And mostly I do it in the middle of the night when I wake up between 3 and 5 or something like that. And what I found was, as a teacher, I was very stressed with students, and sometimes they'd bait you and you'd say things you shouldn't say, and they would say things then in reaction, and this is with teenagers. And I found that I was actually looking at myself before I said anything. I could, you know, focus better and be aware, I suppose, in the moment, and be aware of what was happening before I sort of suddenly responded with anger or suddenly said the wrong thing that would fuel the situation. So that was one of the benefits. And at home too, it was very beneficial in the way I dealt with my own teenagers. And
how so? This is interesting to me, yes.
I suppose when you have an interaction that could be fiery, where, say, a student, your child, my son, would refuse to do something, or he'd say, "Get off my back," and you could have an argument about it.
Yeah.
And instead I would sort of watch what was happening, and I would actually notice myself not saying what I was about to say. I'd actually think the thought before I actually said it.
I'd
think,
so you'd pause.
I'm glad I didn't say that. That would have really fueled it even further.
Yes.
So I'm able to just step back and be more self-observing of myself before I actually, you know, we often speak before we think. We're just, you know, always doing that sort of thing, and that's why we get ourselves into a bit of arguments with people, or we get ourselves into stressful situations. So I found it in that respect very, very good. But then I became unemployed a year ago due to my contract running out, and so I could have been, and my mother died as well, so there was a few things happening of cancer. So I began meditating even more, and I was very stressed and upset, but I found that I coped with things a lot better, and it came to me that I should start a vegetable garden, so I did that.
Well, that can be a meditation exercise
too.
Absolutely.
Definitely. So I
think
that's
been my experience.
Yeah, so I did that, and it sort of really helped me sort of get by in the day without stressing about not working or thinking, what should I do, because I love to be busy. But also,
there is nothing like putting a kind of a trowel in the soil.
Oh, yeah, and just now with the rain, the vegetables are all coming up, and it's just fantastic. But the other key to my success, I think, is the use of a mantra. And I found one that really sat with me, and being someone that's read a lot of spiritual books, I found something that really sat with me good. And
so it's something you say as you're sitting.
Yeah. And I found that if I use that in meditation, then I can very quickly revert to my meditative state when I'm standing in a queue, driving in the car, working in the garden, just by bringing that mantra in and repeating that. And I've found that very, very beneficial. So, yeah.
That's great, because sometimes people need props to do this, in a sense, to help focus their attention. Vonda, fantastic call. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very
much. So you've been really doing a three-year meditation challenge.
I'd say so. Probably the first year it wasn't as consistent, but the last 2 years been extremely consistent, yeah.
Matthew Johnston, what when you first started, because we've only asked people to do this for 6 weeks, but when you first started, what sort of clocked you over into doing it in a more regular way? Was there a point where you just went, I've just got to do this?
Well, for anyone who knows me or my books, who might have read I Had a Black Dog, I went through quite many years of depression, and I was always looking for that quick fix. I was always looking, for the magic pill, the silver bullet, whatever it was. And I've since realised that there is no silver bullet. It's really a potpourri of many things. And I think, exercise is very important. Good communication is one of them. But meditation is probably most integral, and for me, for my management of my mood and my well-being.
How does it affect the depression particularly?
Oh, look, I think it just...
What shifts? Because I have heard that for people, some people who have very severe depression, actually doing a practice that involves more rumination, or that can trigger more rumination, is not necessarily helpful, in fact.
Oh, look,
So it's not for everybody.
It's not for everybody, and I think if you're very severely depressed, it can be very, very difficult. But I think, when you're mildly depressed, or, just coming out of it, or going into it, it can be a very, very useful thing to do. I really like the previous caller's thing about, how everything sort of wiped off. I like the idea of being Teflon-coated by meditation, And I certainly can take a lot more slings and arrows when I've been meditating. I just seem to take the day with more stride and with more calmness, if you like.
So it builds your resilience.
Absolutely.
Is it because I'm just interested in getting to the heart of the dynamic there? Is it something about kind of building some internal infrastructure or something?
I think so. And one of the things that
feeling more comfortable in your own skin.
More comfortable. And the thing that I've learned is that our minds do chat. And what we can do is we can train our brains a little bit like a misbehaving dog. And what I believe is, what I do a lot of my meditation now is when I'm meditating, I actually say words like still, soft, calm, clear, these sorts of words, and I'll just say them in a very, very quiet voice. And as I'm doing it, I really think about my breath slowing down, my heart slowing down, and I think our bodies start to respond to ourselves if we're saying those. Those in many ways are my mantra as well. If I'm kind of busy, I'll just say the things very, very quietly in my mind, in the back of my mind, and I do tend to, 90% of the time get to a calm place.
90% of the time.
90%
of the time. It's interesting that there's a 10%. What is it? What's happening when there's that 10%?
Oh, look, it tends to be just when I'm really busy, when I'm really stressed, if I'm travelling a lot, if I'm not eating well, all that sort of stuff, if I'm not getting a lot of exercise.
That's a lot of variables.
It is a lot of variables, and recently I have been, I've been travelling a lot for the last 2 months, and that sort of always upsets stuff, but I just try.
Probably touring the book on meditation.
Yeah, well,
ironically.
It's been Mental Health Month, which has been mental. you know. So, you know, on planes, like, planes are fantastic places to meditate.
I think so.
You can't go anywhere.
I did read yesterday that there's a debate about whether they should introduce wireless on aeroplanes. And I was thinking, well, actually, no, because it's the one spot where you can actually switch off.
That's right.
Let's come to Stephen. Stephen, you've got a point to make about transcendental meditation. Welcome.
Hello. Yes. I'm sort of dumbfounded by a great amount of ignorance about a technique that really just is so superior to all these techniques of concentration and that type of thing. I've been doing TM for 30 years.
Well, what's the difference? Just explain that for us a little.
Well, I don't know. Maharishi just speaks very clearly that the TM techniques, like flying in a jet plane as opposed to travelling in a motor car, you know, really... to answer your question, all these concentration techniques, the mind just stays on the surface, but with the TM technique, it takes a far quicker dive, you know. You know, the statistics of people achieving greater states of calm in, 2 years of TM, where it's taken 30 years of Zen practice or something like that.
Okay, all right. Well, we obviously don't have time to go into the detail of that technique, but it's been around for a long time, and there's certainly a lot of people who enjoy the technique from what we've heard. In terms of being a meditator generally,
yeah.
What's the impact been on you, Stephen?
Well, I'm Western kid. I've had all the influences of Western kid. You know, a pretty decadent life at times, but I've sort of moved on through it, and I've got aspirations for the future. And, you know, I hope to self-actualise, I think, you know, find a place in the nature and just generally work with a hopeful future. You know?
Hey, thanks for calling, Stephen. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Stephen, who is more into transcendental meditation as opposed to mindfulness meditation, and certainly there's a big movement of people doing transcendental meditation. Matthew, any thoughts there?
Look, as I said, I think different strokes for different folks. You know, I think whatever works for you. I have no hard and fast rules. I think there are people who are very stick to their guns about particular types, and I just go, well, whatever works for you, you know, what you find brings you a little bit of inner peace, you know, just do that.
Mm.
And by all means, you know, there's thousands of books out there on meditation, and I think, you know, just try and find the one that sort of sits with you and resonates with you.
It's a very emphatic group who are involved in TM.
Absolutely.
I have to say,
yes.
Over the years I've experienced that, so good to hear from Stephen. Lyndon, you've been a daydreamer all your life. Welcome to the show. How have you been going?
Well, I suppose I'm lucky in that I think I can slip into that sort of state quite easily. And my interests are bushwalking, swimming, yoga, those sorts of things. So maybe I spend too much time in that state sometimes. I'm not quite sure. But I guess the point I'd like to make is that I think when it is an entrenched part of your life, it enables you to be able to... find the big picture, particularly in stressful situations, so that it allows you to put those things that are making you anxious, stressed, angry, whatever, into the perspective of your whole life. You know, that sort of, that the sun still comes up the next morning regardless of what's happened the night before. And I think it also allows you to come to some profound conclusions which helps you accept when really serious things happen, like you lose someone close to you. And 3 years ago, we lost our house in a house fire. Oh. And one of the and at that particular situation, when, you know, everyone was saying, oh, all the things you've lost your photos and all the things that you love, and, you know, the journals that the kids had done at school and all that sort of stuff. And I think in that moment, I was able to come to the realization that what I'd been collecting were things that I loved because they were symbols of things that I still already had, like a good marriage and healthy children, and I've been brought up in a good family. So the material things were actually just symbolic of that, and so I hadn't actually lost that. I just lost the symbol. So I think, you know, meditation allows you to be able to find those sorts of deep perspectives that helps you stay happy, which is a really important part of life.
That's a lovely point.
And makes you enjoy your life more, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, not sweating the
Well, it's worth sweating the small stuff sometimes because the devil's in the detail sometimes. But
maybe that's where I do miss out. People often tell me that I don't read my emails properly or whatever. Probably because I'm thinking about my next swim or my next yoga class.
You're just operating on another plane altogether, I can hear it. Lyndon, thanks very much for the call, I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, nice to talk to you, Natasha, and I love your program.
Thank you. Okay. That's a great point, isn't it? Let me come back to Chantelle and Claudine. Chantelle, what next for you, do you think? Thanks for waiting on the line.
Oh, that's right. It's been fascinating listening. I think just carrying on because I think, you know, the sort of understanding more about how I've thought that thinking could hold me together and coming back to the sense of awareness and presence and mindfulness. So I think just, you know, kind of, you know, getting to know that more, integrating it, embedding it in my life. So I'll keep on with you know, the meditation from the website and also, you know, the sort of dance stuff I've been doing as well and just, yeah, keep embedding it.
Yeah, we want to come over to your house and have a dance. Yeah. It sounds kind of blissful.
It's not all sort of tearing around. Like, a lot of it's very, very, very slow. And it's very, it's lovely because you really let your body...
In silence? No music?
With music. You know, so you choose your kind of music, not with words, just, you know, just okay. Instruments. But yeah, but it's very much about sort of getting body mind together. So, but letting your body lead your way in the dance, and it's just amazing because you think, my body's amazing. It knows so much. It can support me. It's so wise. But you don't need to think so much.
Yes,
you know, you can just follow.
That's definitely been my experience with yoga on and off over the years. Claudine, how about you? What's next?
In terms of the meditation.
Your own practice. Yeah.
Yes, my own practice.
And it's cool if you don't continue it. It's been an interesting exercise.
Yes. Well, I've gotten past that initial stage that I went through, which was every time I sat down to meditate, I thought about all the things we had to do from the back end of the meditation challenge perspective. So that's gone. I can now enjoy meditation for what it is. I think I'm going to do a short, like a course, like a 6-week course.
Yeah, good one.
On my own.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Ditch the family, I think, on this one. Claudine, thank you very much for your support in pulling this all together for us. It's been fantastic. You and
it's been a real
Kathy
pleasure.
Johnson from the ABC Health and Wellbeing team. And Matthew, I just want to wrap on this distinction between awareness and thinking. It's a subtle one.
It is.
Because, you know, you think you are aware. I mean, you know,
and you think about
what you're aware of in any given moment. So, there's a very meta and meta and meta on top of the meta, isn't it?
Like, you give yourself a nosebleed. It's like contemplating a universe, you know.
Well, we like doing that.
Well, one of the things I just wanted to say was that, you know, I recently did a talk at the Gawler Foundation in Melbourne, which is a retreat for people with cancer. And I also consult for the Black Dog Institute. And the one thing that really struck me while I was there was, you know, in mental health, we constantly talk about mental health and mental well-being and mindfulness and all that sort of stuff and positive psychology. And at the Gawler Foundation, where they talked about, you know, physical well-being, the one thing that came throughout the conference was mindfulness and meditation. So, you know, it doesn't just affect us mentally, but it also affects us physically as well. We can really protect our bodies from, you know, things like cancer as well through it. So I just thought that was an amazing recognition.
Yeah, there's an interesting emerging body of evidence there around, the relationship between things like stress hormones and all sorts of indications around heart health and beyond, but still a very active area of research. So we have to watch the evidence
closely
before we make big grand claims about cures for cancer, let me tell you. But yes, so absolutely.
That
kind of differentiation between body and mind is starting to conflate, which is only a healthy thing,
I think. Great.
Let's start knowing that states of mind affect states of body and body health. Thank you for your participation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Chantelle Jackson, thank you for your participation. It's Chantelle, I know. I've been slightly mispronouncing that. Isn't that rotten?
Oh, everybody does.
I need to be more mindful. Wonderful to have your contribution throughout the weeks too. Excellent.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely.
And thank you to all of you who posted on the website, just to let you know that the meditation toolkit will stay online forever. Some of you have been asking and wondering whether it'll all fall off the edge of a cliff at the end of the 6 weeks, and it won't. Life is long, and so is our website. So you can get on the webpage and maybe bookmark it so you can go back and use it over time. In the meantime, continue this conversation on that page or on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you, and perhaps you've heard things today that have connected with your own experience. Maybe build on that and explain that more for us. Okay, well, let's come. We're going to talk midlife crisis, and if ever there was a topic for now, it's that. And you're with RN, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning, and you're with Life Matters as well.
Start early and go hard. Christmas has arrived, so exhorted a spokesman for the retail industry. But top economist Ross Gittins warns the relentless culture of consumption means spending ourselves into misery. The pursuit of more is even corrupting politics. No one dares to say, be satisfied, you've got enough. A Modern Prophet on the Religion and Ethics Report here on RN this afternoon at 5:30.
Recently on the program, we talked about, well, how the way we relate to our sexuality might evolve over the years. And we got a big response from men and women at every age and stage. And the discussion got one of our regular contributors, Ali Varenti, thinking about the machinations of midlife and the different shades, though perhaps not shades of grey, I hope, that a midlife crisis can come in. Take it away, Ali.
I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. Woody Allen sums it up for lots of us who've started to panic that we've reached life's third act and it's only got four. Trouble is that for lots of us midlifers, we've lost our lines and are scrambling about in search of a new script. You don't have to be Woody Allen to worry about death. A midlife crisis usually occurs between the ages of, I don't know, 45 and 60. It might be an epiphany, a kick in the existential guts, or more subtle and less dramatic, a gradual and creeping suspicion. Is that all there is? The tropes of the classic midlife crisis are all too familiar. Popular culture has overploughed them for years. You know, the red convertible, Duco's shining, the driver's bald pate shining, and in the passenger seat his much younger lover. The quest for a new look, a new hat, haircut, a new nose. Doing a Shirley Valentine and getting out of town, or just doing your best to live in the past to avoid the present, let alone the muddy future. Even if you don't accept the midlife crisis concept and reckon it's just one more way for our neoliberal capitalist world to make us feel so bad about ageing we'll consume more stuff, it doesn't change the fact that for lots of us, midlife throws off some pretty major issues. And if apes can have a midlife crisis, as was reported recently, it must be real. What does an ape's midlife crisis look like? Do they bust out for a better tree or hook up with a trimmer ape? I know, swingers parties. But it can be scary, bloody shocking and downright lonely when you feel like all your certainties and lifelines have suddenly left the building, taking your moral compass with them. Who am I? I mean, what have I done with my life, really? And what do I actually believe in anymore? Some midlifers are galvanised into action, any kind of action, because time's running out. Others are miserable with paralysis and incapable of making a decision for fear it's the wrong one. There's been some kind of mistake. This is not the life I had planned. Someone must be living mine out there and I've got a hold of theirs. At least their genes fit. 2 years ago, when I turned 50, my younger sister died. I'd already started to question my whole raison d'etre sometime before this, but there's nothing like the death of someone you love to bring on a full-on crisis of identity and a major soul search. The compulsion to reinvent one's life can make people act out in all kinds of ways. They might suddenly leave a good job or end a long-term relationship to begin anew and emboldened, leaving friends, family and colleagues worried sick, devastated or just bemused. Some of my friends in psychic freefall have left the spouse and sold the house. There's nothing left to talk about once we'd discussed the kids and put the rubbish out. I don't know, or maybe we didn't spend enough time on our relationship and now there's nothing left of it worth holding on to. Others announce they're giving up on relationships once and for all, while those with more energy and higher libido, maybe, have taken on the quest for a new relationship with the zeal of one of those compulsive Q&A tweeters. While some of my friends are still having sex with their partners and liking it, others are over it and either going through the motions because he needs it more than I do or have closed up shop altogether. These women say that they're no longer interested in sex, that perimenopause is a relief, its accompanying hormonal shake-up, a liberation from the insanity and distraction of intimate relationships. Others still long for passion and intimacy, but they're unsure as to how to make it all happen. Or they lack the wherewithal, the time, the money, or the requisite high-level prose skills for the online dating scene. Some of my best friends are feminists with complex and contradictory views around ageing and sexuality. I'm still really interested in sex, but my increased curiosity and open-mindedness has corresponded with an ageing body I'm less than comfortable in. And, well, a lot of men my age, well, they're just too damaged or sentimental or straight. It really pisses me off. My 80-year-old mother says that she doesn't know how people cope with getting old if they don't read. She reckons books will never let you down like people do. If I go into a bookshop these days, I'm gobsmacked. There's still so much to read. I mean, I know nothing about the American Civil War or Wittgenstein or Bruacton. I'm a classic midlifer, reading Kundera again and wondering if it hurts to have a tummy tuck. Training for a half marathon. Volunteering at a mental health organisation. Panicking ineffectively about global warming and our children's future. And I work in the three most beleaguered professions in Australia, the arts, journalism and education, and worry, really worry that I lack the interest and the funds to pursue a fourth one. And I wonder if I'll ever fall in love again. Perhaps I've grown lazy, bored, or I'm just chronically disappointed. A close friend reckons I'm deeply shallow, and I say, hello, is that an affair you're having there, or are you just scared of dying? If we are at this point of our lives, it's crucial that after the initial shock and confusion, that we manage to locate something to build on and work towards. We're in transition, and it's okay to feel weird for a bit. Generate, not stagnate. Say it with me. Go get something to love, something to do, and something to look forward to. Or we can call on Woody Allen, because for a half-empty kind of guy, he has an optimism he can't suppress. Life is full of misery, loneliness, and suffering, and it's all over much too soon.
Verenti, where would we be without your wisdom? Thank you. I feel like it was only recently that we were sharing the birth of your child. Now you're contemplating midlife. Life moves apace. I just want to share an email, a post that we got on our webpage in response to Old Dogs yesterday. And that was a book of photographs about what old dogs can teach us, literally old canines we're talking about here, not old sea dogs. Simon wrote, I lost my dog Tom in September. He was almost 18 years old. So I've had him in my life for almost half of my life. While I've had family and friends pass away over the years, I've never ever grieved like this before. I've had many people react as though it's childish for me to react like this over the loss of a dog. The only people who really understand it are those who've been there themselves. It was great to hear this program. And knowing friends who recently lost a dog and it's totally thrown them out of whack. Yes, it is a very difficult grief to explain. I just also wanted to say that Suzanne McCourt, a few of you asked about where her wall of fame for dogs that have passed on is, and we've linked to her blog, which is where that is, and you can submit there. So head to our website, abc.net.au/radionational, look for Life Matters, and then look for that story yesterday, and you'll find a link there. And I'm sure Suzanne would love to hear from you. Now, straight after the news is Michael Cathcart with Books and Arts Daily. You've got a fantastic guest today.
We've got Column Tobin Natasha, who the well-known Irish writer, both of fiction and of non-fiction, and he's written an astonishing book. It's just a tiny little book, and it's called The Testament of Mary. Now, this is Mary, the mother of Jesus, mm-hmm. and it's as though she told her story at a distance from Christianity. So it's the story of a mother who's seen the appalling suffering of her son at the crucifixion and her bewilderment that that he should have followers, that they should believe all these impossible things.
Good, so a good voice to write from. You know, when I was in Italy, I just kept seeing these images of Mary staring back at me in every museum thinking, and I was left thinking, what is she actually feeling with all these people hanging around her feet?
Well, it's not that serene Mary that you meet. You know, it is this other Mary, quite a confronting Mary, and I think some people will think it's an heretical book.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Thanks, Michael.
Good on you.
Next on Life Matters tomorrow, we're going to look at the National Disability Insurance Scheme. You know, it's all in the money and how it's distributed. Stay with RN, coming up to the 10 a.m. news.
We don't have to go gung-ho, we do go very gently. You'll hear the tone of the rock. The rock will change. It'll have a different sound. These things are 370 million years old here.
We're in a shale pit about 15 kilometres south of Canal. You may not know where you're going, but you'll always end up where you're meant to be. Off Track with me, Joel Werner. Sunday morning, 6:30, here on RN.